This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. The history of censorship in the United States is a long and ugly one, and it's far from over. But it's also a deeply ironic tale, with seemingly successful attempts to stamp out unwanted expression ultimately giving way to more and more freedom of speech. In the new book, The Mind of the Censor and the Eye of the Beholder, legendary First Amendment lawyer Robert Corn Revere documents how attempts by famous censors such as Anthony Comstock — he was the head of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, and his name became synonymous with priggishness — Frederick Wortham, the communist-friendly psychiatrist whose crusade against comic books in the 1950s changed the publishing industry, and Newton Minow, the sainted FCC chairman who memorably and totally incorrectly denounced television as a vast wasteland, ended up creating backlashes that undermined their attempts to control what Americans could read, watch, and listen to. Corn Revere tells me that although no one cops to being a censor these days, attempts to delegitimate the First Amendment are everywhere around us, especially when it comes to limiting speech in the name of supposedly protecting the feelings of religious, ethnic, and sexual minorities. If you look at the history of this, you find it is the protection of individual speech rights that has made all of the mass movements by minorities and previously marginalized people possible, says Corn Revere. There wouldn't have been a gay rights movement or a woman's movement. Certainly, the civil rights movement was a defining time for protecting the speech of individuals, he continues. He also talks with me about worrying shifts away from robust defenses of the First Amendment among millennials and Gen Z, why every plan to put elected officials in charge of speech would be worse than trusting the relatively unregulated marketplace of ideas, and why he's ultimately optimistic about the future of free expression. It's a great conversation, but before we get to it, I want to introduce you to today's sponsor, the Longtime Academy, a new podcast about how to be a good ancestor. This is a show about time and how we think about time, and it starts from the understanding that short-term thinking can be really stressful. Some of us find it difficult to plan for tomorrow or next week, let alone next year or 10 years from now. And the show believes that long-term thinking can help. So if you've ever felt unproductive, exhausted, or worried about the future, if you're anxious about climate change and partisan politics, if you feel powerless to change the path our world is on, the Longtime Academy can help. You're going to hear from people like Brian Eno, Celeste Headlee, George the Poet, Roman Krasnarik, Jay Griffiths, and Adrienne Marie Brown. And you're going to learn how they embrace long-term thinking. The Longtime Academy is an audio documentary, but it also includes practical exercises designed to expand your sense of time and help you be a good ancestor for the folks who hopefully will come after us. I checked out an early episode of the Longtime Academy that featured Brian Eno, one of the most innovative and provocative musicians of the past 50 years, and I really dug it, so I think you may too. So search for the Longtime Academy anywhere you listen to podcasts. Its slogan sums up its ethos: life is short, time is long. Go check out the Longtime Academy. And now, here's the Reason interview with Bob Corn Revere, talking about the mind of the censor and the eye of the beholder. Bob Corn Revere, author of The Mind of the Censor and the Eye of the Beholder, The First Amendment and the Censor's Dilemma. Thanks for talking to Reason.
Oh, thanks for having me, Nick.
All right. So this, this is a book that is just filled with riches. I didn't want it to end, which is rare to say about any nonfiction book, but especially books about law. Although this is really more about the culture of free speech, really, than the legal, kind of nitpickings of it. Give me the elevator pitch of The Mind of the Censor and the Eye of the Beholder.
Well, it's a little bit hard to categorize, but you put your finger on it in saying that it's not a law book. This isn't just a discussion of cases. It's really a discussion of how free expression developed in America against a very repressive legal standard for the time, but also just the mindset of people and those that made censorship a particular crusade. And so this is a series of stories about episodes in American history where, because of a culture of free expression that we have in America and because of developing case law that pushed back against that, we ended up where we are with free speech.
Which is, we have a culture of free speech, which is pretty great, but it's always in peril. And I want to get towards the end. I want to talk about, you know, you are an early baby boomer, if I'm not mistaken. I'm a late baby. Okay. You're a mid baby boomer. I'm a late baby boomer. We kind of came of age during a period where free speech was so kind of dominant and just expanding. And that may be a blip. I mean, I'm worried about that. But let's go to the beginning of the, you start your book with talking about Anthony Comstock, the ultimate figure in kind of censorship, both hard and soft censorship in American culture. He ran a group in the 19th century called the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, and their logo has one part of the logo is a gentleman taking somebody and putting them in jail, and the other is a gentleman in a top hat burning books. Who was
kind of says it all, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. Who was Comstock, and how does he exemplify what you call the censor's dilemma?
Well, in a way, he caused the censor's dilemma. I don't think he experienced the censor's dilemma so much. He's a guy who started out as purely a vigilante, going after what he saw as smut dealers. He caught the attention of the patriarchs who ran the YMCA in New York.
The Young Men's Christian Association.
Exactly. Yep. And these were the richest and most influential men in New York who were the patrons of the YMCA. And they took this on as a reformist project and basically bankrolled and sponsored Comstock to continue his work. And in fact, to go to Washington, D.C. to lobby for a new federal obscenity law that covered the males. This empowered Comstock not just to be a spokesman for these issues and an activist, as we say in today's parlance, but he was someone who actually was empowered to enforce the law as a special agent of the post office. And that and his role as the secretary, or really the head of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, gave him broad authority indeed. Yeah. And, you make a point when you start out this question by saying that we are baby boomers, we lived in a different environment. You're right. There was no culture of free expression at the time Comstock started. For us, it was when all of these issues were developing. They were being debated in society. They were being argued in the courts. And so we experienced a very different atmosphere.
Yeah. So define the censor's dilemma.
The censor's dilemma is the problem that someone who exercises the power of a censor has great authority, but also feels tainted, feels that they are illegitimate in a society dedicated to free expression. As I said, Comstock didn't experience much because he had no problems with censorship. As the seal for the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice showed it, he was quite proud of his work. But the problem was the culture pushed back. Eventually, we developed a culture of free expression because of his excesses. We developed a law of free expression in large part because the courts, in pushing back against the censorious work of that society, developed a law of free expression. And so it ruined the name of censorship after Comstock. Mm-hmm. As I say, he was not conflicted at all.
And to the extent that anybody even knows of him, really, I mean, outside of legal circles and history, you might know the term Comstockery, which is
It's remarkable that so few people remember him because he was the national arbiter of morality for over four decades during his career. He had a huge impact on American society, and he is largely forgotten, except as a joke.
Right. And Comstockery is, it's a buffoon, a person who is consumed with, the fear, and people like H.L. Mencken made fun of him. George Bernard Shaw, I guess, coined the term or popularized Comstockery, but somebody who's obsessed that sex is everywhere and that he has to stamp it out in order to purify and keep American culture and particularly American men pure somehow. One of the things that's fascinating about Comstock, he obviously did a lot of cases, and sometimes, he could be walking down the street and see a picture in an art gallery or something and be like, I've got to stamp this out. But could you talk about the case it comes at towards the end of his, or at the end of his career, but where he actually tried to put Margaret Sanger, or he put Margaret Sanger's husband in jail for selling material that had to do with things like contraception and birth control. And what happened there, and what does it reveal about Comstock's character.
Yeah, this was Comstock's last case. He died about a week after the end of this case in 1915. But he indeed prosecuted William Sanger, who was Margaret Sanger's husband, Margaret Sanger being the founder of what became Planned Parenthood and an advocate for birth control. It illustrates a couple of things. I mean, one is it shows how broad this conception of obscenity was at the time. Under the Comstock law, anything having to do with contraception, abortion, anything having to do with sex, really, that Comstock considered to be impure could be prosecuted. Hell, there was one case where he prosecuted a pamphlet that had an article about the mating habits of marsupials. It was really unlimited.
He's one of these characters that if he was created or invented, nobody would believe him.
Absolutely.
You know, you wouldn't believe the author that put this guy together.
Absolutely. But he did more than just go after the sale of this material. Margaret Sanger was feared that she was going to be prosecuted and went to England. Comstock personally went to her house while she was away and persuaded her husband that he was a supporter of her work, that he wanted to have her work translated into other languages. And William Sanger rifled around in a drawer and finally found a pamphlet and handed it to him for that purpose. That was the reason William Sanger was prosecuted, and he was convicted.
Yeah. And you talk about how Comstock loved putting people in jail, and they would often be sentenced to hard labor, and a number of people
Yes.
died. I mean, as a result of, if it's the late 19th century and you're put in prison for a couple of years doing hard labor and you're, over the age of 40,
Yes.
chances are you're going to come out of that a broken man.
He particularly went after his adversaries, anyone who opposed his law, people who advocated free thought, for example, and he would try to make sure that the sentence was hard labor, which a number of men our age were sentenced in that way. But more than that, he rejoiced in the idea of driving people to suicide. He was openly boasted of causing at least 15 suicides during his career.
So how did Comstock, and again, you said he didn't experience because he was held in esteem and also he was kind of impervious to, personal criticism or irony or anything. But how did he start to create the backlash against, a just moral, world of media and of literature and art and other forms of creative expression? He helped simultaneously by pushing the boundaries of censorship, he helped create that backlash. What's kind of the dynamic?
Well, that's right. Well, first of all, even his supporters would distance themselves from him at times because he was so zealous and believed he had a monopoly on morality and that anyone else, even people on his side, were somehow adversaries. And so he didn't make many friends, but he was still tremendously influential. One thing that happened was that the culture began to change. And part of that was he was so excessive. He was seen on New York subways putting patches over museum advertisements because he thought that the images were too revealing. And so he became a natural subject of ridicule. And so that's one thing that caused public opinion to change. And he was also lampooned a lot in newspapers and in the illustrated magazines at the time. People were in a way kind of whistling past the graveyard because they would make fun of it, but they were also afraid of it. And so there was that dynamic going on. The law was not protective of free speech at all. We had no First Amendment jurisprudence in the 19th century. That wouldn't come along until a third of the way through the 20th century. And so there were no protective standards of First Amendment law. And arguments were being made in the 1870s that would later, 50 years later, 80 years later, be accepted by the courts. But it took that long for the case law to develop. So that combination of cultural change and legal change ultimately caused the backlash. And he drove it by being so zealous.
As we move forward through this discussion, could talk about obscenity as a type of language that does not get First Amendment protection, even today. You are producing obscene work, it can be banned. What is obscenity as opposed to just free speech that people don't like? And how How did it get carved out quickly, you know, or in a concise form? You know, how did a doctrine of saying, okay, well, you know what, free speech is okay, but obscenity, now that's a different matter. Where, you know, how did that start to develop through Comstock and after?
That's a longer conversation. There are a number of categories that we call unprotected speech. Right. Have been recognized over the years.
And others like libel and defamation and things like that.
Defamation. Right?
Yeah. Fraud.
Those fall into the list. Speech that is integral to criminal activity, and it's part of the crime, then that's not protected. And those categories have developed over the years. Obscenity really wasn't a concept when the Constitution was adopted. The framers of the Constitution wouldn't have known about it. The first obscenity prosecutions in America began in the early 19th century as sort of common law claims. And they were sort of an outgrowth of blasphemy and so on. It wasn't until later in Comstock's time that the issue of obscenity began to gel as a concept. And it was not until 1957 the Supreme Court addressed it and said that, yes, it's an unprotected category, but everything up to the edge of obscenity is protected. Anything that lacks redeeming social value and isn't focused on explicit descriptions or depictions of sex. And so people often confuse this. They think of pornography and obscenity. Pornography is just a general term that talks about sexual entertainment. Obscenity is where it falls off the edge of the First Amendment earth, where you go across that line. But it is an increasingly restricted area, whereas in Comstock's time, it was all expansive and included anything he thought was immoral.
So, and now, I mean, I guess you could make an argument in a kind of free speech culture, having a definition of obscenity and squeezing it down to cover less and less, it actually helps guarantee more free speech in a way.
In a way, it does, yes, as long as you keep those barriers high and maintain that the presumption is in favor of free speech, and then the burden is on the government to show that something falls into one of these very narrow categories.
So let's jump forward a couple of decades after Comstock's death to Frederick Wortham. And, a fascinating psychiatrist, a German emigre who wrote a book. He's best known now also as a kind of joke character for a book called Seduction of the Innocent, which was about how comic books, which had become a mass medium in the late 30s and early 40s, and were the motive force in juvenile delinquency and homosexuality and lesbianism among children, all sorts of ills. He's a fascinating figure for all sorts of reasons. He worked in New York. He had clinics in Harlem, and he was witnessing during the Depression, kind of a lot of children who were just kind of left behind. And then he seized on, comic books as like the thing that was causing all of this. He was a good progressive. He worked with a bunch of left-wing writers. He was very sympathetic to the Soviet Union and to communism. He was worked on the defense of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. He helped take care of their kids after they were orphaned. This is a fascinating character. How does Frederick Wortham fit into your kind of pantheon, your league of supervillains when it comes to, censorship?
Well, he does a couple of things in the book. One is I wanted to illustrate the point that the arguments over censorship are not partisan arguments. They come from both the left and the right. It really just depends on whether or not someone believes that the power of the state should be used either to prohibit speech they consider to be particularly evil or to promote speech they think is particularly beneficial. So that's the defining characteristic of a censor. The second main characteristic is a belief in their absolute certainty that they are right. That was Comstock's chief characteristic. It certainly was a characteristic of Frederick Wortham as well, and of the other characters that I chronicle in the book. And then the third characteristic is what we talked about earlier, the censor's dilemma, where after Comstock, everyone who was engaged in this business, absolutely certain that they needed to restrict evil speech or promote good speech, they all denied that what they were doing was in any way censorship because Comstock had made it look so bad.
Yeah. So what was the nub of Wortham's case against comic books? And, you know, how did he kind of work channels to go from just being, you know, kind of a prig or, you know, a Brent Bozell type character who is also shows up, also, you know, prominently and towards the end of your book, but, you know, just somebody who's kind of saying, oh, this is bad stuff. This is bad stuff, you know, which is an exercise of free speech. Don't let your kids read this, to actually working to change the availability of, you know, of speech he considered problematic.
He actively lobbied for laws to restrict the sale of comic books. He was used as an expert witness in supporting Los Angeles ordinance to restrict the sales of comic books. And there's a really interesting link to Comstock in this way, in that Wortham really began his work right at the same time that the Supreme Court had struck down a New York law that was sort of a child of Comstock that related to the same kinds of things. Comstock had taken action against dime novels, mm-hmm. which were luridly cheap novels of the time, cowboys and criminals and all of that, that were very exciting, that Comstock argued caused the same things that we're discussing for comic books: juvenile delinquency, sexual promiscuity, all of these things. And so a number of states, New York among them, passed laws restricting the sales of these kinds of books. And in 1948, the Supreme Court struck down the New York law, saying it was too vague to be constitutional under the First Amendment. At that same time, more by coincidence, but that's when Wortham began his work, trying to create the same kind of regime, the same kind of law for comic books. And what he did was say the Supreme Court was completely wrong. And so he tried to work with government and prosecutors and lawmakers to craft laws that would survive. And he simply said the courts are misguided here. And so he would give long expert testimony and his own legal opinions, even though he was a psychiatrist, about what the law ought to be. He worked with Congress trying to seek a federal law. He worked with legislators in New York as well to try and create a law there. He was unsuccessful in all of these, but because he was able to marshal political pressure from Congress about create the palpable fear of a federal law, the comic book industry caved in and adopted what we've know as or knew as the comic book code, right, to try, sort of sanitize the world of comics.
And that, I mean, that illustrates one of the ways that censorship works, right? Because the comics code and later, you know, the Motion Picture Association of America's rating system and whatnot are, you know, they're pitched as, you know, self-regulation by an industry. We are going to do right by our people and we're going to clean up our act before, you know, so the government doesn't have to get involved. This is a win for, you know, freedom and self-regulation and things like that. What, you know, what did the Comics Code do and how did it change what was being offered by the comic book industry?
Well, the comic book code was a sort of takeoff on what in earlier times, the motion picture industry had been the production code, where you had a centralized authority to decide whether or not scripts would be acceptable, whether or not movies could be.
And then that, the Hayes office or the Hayes code, it was
exactly
talked about. And that came out after there were a series of scandals involving Hollywood stars, et cetera. And again, it was seen as a way of staving off censorship because it was not clear that movies were considered speech in the same way that a newspaper was.
At that
right?
time, yeah. Movies did not receive constitutional protection. That would come right. years later. So at the time, there were a number of state authorities that had the ability to pass on whether or not movies could be shown in their states. That had been approved by the Supreme Court earlier times. And so the threat of both state regulation and federal action was very real at the time that the comics or the production movie production code in the Hayes office was created. And so the industry was simply reacting to that. Later on in the 60s, after the law was beginning to ease up, we have what we now know as the Motion Picture Association rating scheme. And it doesn't operate in the same way as the production code did and really freed up things in ways that didn't exist before. But the comic book code in the 50s that was adopted in the wake of hearings with Estes Kefauver and others, you know, that was modeled on the earlier production code. And it basically created a stranglehold for the comics book industry that really devastated it for a time.
Yeah. And it changed what was seen as, what the types of comics. Horror comics were out, which had been pretty violent. True crime comics disappeared, and you got a kind of saccharine version of Batman and Robin and Superman.
We got the comics that you and I grew up
with. Right, right. Which then, over time, all these codes all kind of start to break down, and eventually they really are not governing anymore. And as we head into, I want to talk next about kind of TV regulation in particular, but Wortham also, part of what he was about was a fear of kind of mass media, right? That, suddenly it was a different world in, post-war America than, obviously mass media had been cranking up movies, radio, things like that in the earlier part of the 20th century. But suddenly you had this vast, production and distribution mechanism where lots of different people, you couldn't control who was reading what and things like that. And it seems that Wortham, in a way that is still with us, and as a psychiatrist was saying, these kids are growing up in bad circumstances and they are having their desires and their delinquency imprinted on them by the things they consume, the things they read and watch and listen to. Was he accurately describing what was going on, or was he kind of living in a dream world, both in the way that he described comic books and their effects?
I'll say a couple of things. One, Wortham was living in a dream world, and he did have that reaction against all mass media. He had much the same reaction to television, although he wasn't as active in opposing televised violence as others. He really focused on comic books. But he really did believe in this sort of direct cause and effect notion that if comics created some allure, that it would turn children into little zombies that would right. follow it. He particularly said that Batman and Robin and Wonder Woman would turn kids gay, right. and that Superman was a fascist figure that would create a disrespect.
Even though, we had, people could read Superman beating up Hitler, on an almost monthly basis during World War II, we couldn't have won the war without him.
Exactly. But what was interesting is that if you read Seduction of the Innocent, which was his 1954 book that came out right before the Kefauver hearings, it's really just a collection of anecdotes. And it reads more like a literary critic than a psychiatrist. But it reminds me of the scene in Ghostbusters. Well, Bill Murray is conducting this bogus research. And when he's questioned about it, he says, "Back off, man, I'm a scientist." That was kind of Wortham's attitude toward it, saying, "I'm the authority and I know what's true here." The problem was, apart from the fact that it wasn't supported by the better science, even of the time, and certainly not now. Years later, when his research notes were later reviewed by someone in the field, found that he had simply fabricated a lot of the stories. He combined accounts from different patients. He included accounts of kids he'd never spoken with, and simply wove his narrative to support his theory that comic books were bad.
Yeah. In a fascinating footnote, his last work was actually a kind of celebration of fan fiction and of fanzines in the late 60s and right. early 70s. So he went, he kind of towards the end of his life had he could go on comic book convention circuits where he was kind of an object of ridicule, but he yes. ended up celebrating fan fiction, which is kind of fascinating,
Yeah, it is yeah. fascinating and something that Comstock never did, but he right. did. And still does. I mean, Wortham is still a figure in comic book lore
right.
and it's parodied in all kinds of fiction.
So that brings us to, Wortham is kind of, he's a Central European guy who speaks with an accent and is a kind of nut job psychiatrist who is also like a communist and this and that. I mean, he's a weird character. And, yes. And when you talk about the censor's dilemma or also the, people back away from people like Wortham, because it's like, obviously, he's a little bit crazy, if not completely crazy. But then we get to another figure in your book, Newton Minow, who was the FCC, head under John F. Kennedy. I mean, and yes. Newton Minow is most famous for his vast wasteland speech where he said, he looks at TV in the early 60s, and he sees a vast wasteland. There's just like nothing worth, you know, on there. And this is terrible. Newton Minow has never really been, you know, people don't distance from him. He's still around. He's still around. And every decade that his vast wasteland speech marks an anniversary, people come out and talk about what a great guy he was and what a, you know, what a prophet. And, oh, he was so important. You talk about Newton Minow as kind of defining censorship by raised eyebrow. Who was Yes. Newton Minow, and why was the vast wasteland speech so important?
Well, again, Newton Minow was, as you say, the FCC chairman under John F. Kennedy. He is best known for a speech that he gave in 1961 at the convention of the National Association of Broadcasters, basically poking his finger in their eye, saying, everything you do is crap, and I'm going to make sure it gets better. I am the federal regulator in charge of granting, or more to the point, potentially revoking broadcast licenses. And so when I say, you need to clean things up, you need to clean things up. Now, as I've described it, this regulation by raised eyebrow in most cases, it sort of works sort of like an extortion racket. You know, someone comes in and says, you got a nice business here. It'd be a shame if anything happened to it. And that's what happens with the threats for the movie industry and for the comic book industry. With broadcasting, it's much more direct because we have a system of licensing of broadcast stations, which is kind of ironic when you think about a First Amendment that was created in part to prevent licensing of the press in Europe. Now we have it for broadcasting.
And you, so and, I don't and, that. Yeah, and just very quickly, because the argument for why, oh, well, TV and radio are different than the press, because you could have an infinite number of printing presses, but there's a limited number of TV or radio stations that can fit on the spectrum. You know, so it's an argument about scarcity. And so then it becomes the people's airwave, and the government is going to kind of regulate it so everybody gets a piece of the action, and it represents the Volk or something like that. That's a bad empirical argument, right?
It is a bad empirical argument.
And I mean, it was at the time, yeah.
I go into the history of that and how this argument for scarcity of broadcast frequencies was essentially created to justify the creation of first the Federal Radio Commission and then the Federal Communications Commission. But this is something that's been debunked long ago, as early as 1959, when Ronald Coase wrote an article. He was a Nobel Prize-winning economist at the University of Chicago, and basically said, the electromagnetic spectrum is no different from any other economic good. You have to make sure that it can be rationed in some way. Mostly we do that through the market system. But it's not like it is fundamentally different from other goods. You simply have to make sure that people don't try and use the same property for different purposes, for competing purposes. So, for example, if you wanted to talk about a piece of land, you can't use it for a farm and a parking lot at the same time. You have to find a method of allocation. No different for the spectrum, for the electromagnetic spectrum. It's simply an aspect of physics that it can be used to propagate information. And the ironic thing is that a system of allocation was developing. The courts were beginning to create sort of a prior use notion that someone who'd been using a broadcast frequency could continue on that and had a legally enforceable right to keep others off of it. But federal regulators really wanted to make sure they had the control over this medium. And so they developed this theory and actually worked toward creating this notion of spectrum scarcity so they would have a justification to regulate.
When Minow was working within a framework that was wrong, empirically wrong, as well as kind of philosophically suspect, but then you also do a quick survey of when he was talking about TV as a vast wasteland, and, you know, everybody before cable, everybody before HBO and The Sopranos and Sex and the City and Curb Your Enthusiasm might be willing to say, yeah, you know, TV in 1960 probably kind of sucked. You actually point out that it was there was a lot of different, good, weird, interesting stuff going on.
Well, you know, the Vast Wasteland speech is a great speech. snappy turn of phrase. It has stayed with us. It's the most famous thing that Newton Minow did. But I thought it was worth a fact check. And so I looked at the TV listings for New York the week of the Vast Wasteland speech. And so I spent about a full page in the book listing the various things, including, you know, broadcasts from the Nuremberg trials, all kinds of public affairs shows, different things like that. And so it wasn't, for one thing, the Wasteland wasn't vast at the time. We only had just a few stations. We had three broadcast networks and not the cornucopia of sources that we have today. But even within that framework, when broadcast day didn't go for 24 hours, sort of signed off at midnight or 1 a.m., you still had a lot of quality shows. And so, you know, it wasn't vast. It wasn't a wasteland. Great speech, but wrong.
So, and I'll just point out, I suspect you're familiar with it, but Thomas Dougherty wrote, a historian of popular culture of mass media, wrote a book 20 years ago, 15 years ago, called Cold War, Cool Medium, where he also points out how television in the 50s was filled with all kinds of weird ethnics that we, you know, we think of TV as all like Beaver Cleaverland and whatnot. And even I Love Lucy was a show about a multi-ethnic family kind of coming together. Yes. People like Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen, who is this, you know, a Catholic in a country that was not, you know, Catholics were kind of still suspect, who wore a dress, you know, and had one of the biggest TV audiences on a weekly basis. It, you know, it's fascinating that we dump on TV in a way that just seems to be at odds with, you know, what's going on. And it's, I think part of it is that fear of a mass medium somehow programming us.
Yeah.
You know, so why do you, what accounts for Minow, though his reputation, like people like on the right and the left love him, and they, is it that they love the idea of a guy who is smart and is kind of good looking and has impeccable credentials, and he's gonna make sure everything is good? Or, you know, how does he fulfills a kind of good vision of a censor who, of course, also doesn't really talk about being a censor, but he wants to know what's on.
Yeah, and Minow really abhorred being described as a censor. And, you know, people envision censorship as being people who are, you know, taking out the scissors to cut out things and all of that.
Or these are Southern Baptist burning Beatles records or something
exactly,
like that.
Or in the sense of Comstock dumping armloads of books into a fire. That doesn't encompass everything that the First Amendment talks about, right? It talks about having government control over what people can see or hear. And that's the notion behind federal regulation of broadcasting. It doesn't just allocate who can have a station. It also has standards for what should be broadcast to keep your license. And I think Minow has suffered less ridicule than figures like Comstock or Worthen, because he is of the eat your vegetables, I know what's good for you ilk of censorship.
One of the enduring digs at him, of course, and you point this out, is on Gilligan's Island, you know, which is kind of an archetypal baby boom show, if we have to admit that. But the ship is the SS Minow, because they're making fun of him.
It is the SS Minow, although they spelled it differently from his name. They spelled it like the little fish and not by the FCC bureaucrat.
Before we continue with the recent interview with Bobcorn Revere, I want to introduce you to the other sponsor of today's podcast, BetterHelp Online Therapy. Are you feeling stressed out, run down, anxious, short-tempered? If you are, take the time to take care of yourself by going to betterhelp.com/TRI and start talking to a licensed therapist who won't judge you, but will listen and help you with your problems, whatever they are. That's BETTERHELP.com/TRI for the recent interview. BetterHelp is a customized online therapy system that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with somebody in under 48 hours. If you don't like your first therapist, switch to another, all without the hassle of driving across town and sitting in a waiting room. I know it's a great service because I used it myself, and it really helped me out. If you need to talk it out, and these days we all need to talk it out, go to betterhelp.com/TRI and get 10% off your first month. And now, back to the Reason interview. After, talking about Minow and the FCC, let's actually just to complete the answer,
talking about Minow and the kind of reaction that he had, he didn't have the same kind of public rebuke or ridicule as others who have been discredited, like Anthony Comstock or Frederick Wortham. And I think that is in large part because he was sort of censorship with a happy face. He was sort of this kind of eat your vegetables, I know what is good for you kind of censor. And so the cultural reaction was in many ways very different. But the rebuke that he did get, having the SS Minow in Gilligan's Island named after him, was sort of a much milder form of ridicule than the others suffered.
He casts a kind of long shadow at the FCC, which regulates the licensing of broadcast radio and TV. Obviously, broadcast is still a vast market, but it has kind of been superseded by cable and satellite radio and certainly the internet. But one of the things that you talk about at length in your book, The Mind of the Censor and the Eye of the Beholder, is the indecency wars. And let's stumble from Minow to the indecency wars, because this has to do with a bunch of FCC rulings having to do with broadcasts of things like awards programs, the Golden Globes or whatever, and the Super Bowl. There were in the early 2000s, most famously the wardrobe malfunction at a Super Bowl halftime show involving Janet Jackson and Jason Timberlake, where her bare breast was visible for a couple of seconds, and people acted
9/16 of a second.
Yeah, I mean, so it's like it's not even the Zapruder film length, and it's like, but people responded to that like the entire world had been looking directly into a solar eclipse, and like everything in our heads were burned to by the brightness of that image. There was that share. At an awards program, and Nicole Richie had fleeting expletives. Bono at a music awards program, the Bono of U2, said, this is fucking brilliant. What was going on with the indecency wars? Because this is a kind of continuation of the idea that these fleeting expletives, this fleeting image, something you wouldn't even necessarily know that what was going on with Janet Jackson unless you made a big stink about it, and then that that frame was frozen and reproduced endlessly.
Which it was.
Yeah. So, yeah. What was going on? What was at stake in the indecency wars, and how did that lead to, weirdly, a better outcome for free speech?
Well, in many ways, the chapter on the indecency wars is a continuation of the earlier chapter with Newton Minow, because both of them reflect the ways in which the First Amendment applies differently to the broadcast medium than others. In the Minow chapter, I focus on those sort of positive affirmative mandates that the FCC does through its quote public interest regulation and its negative side effects on programming over time. I talk about various episodes of that. The indecency regulations are the other half of the equation, and they're the parts of those regulations that do more resemble those episodes from Comstock and others of censoring things.
What is the definition of indecent speech? Because we have censorship, or rather we have obscenity law, and that's vague enough, but okay, that has something to do with sex and excretory functions in a way that is stirring our base instincts, and that's bad. But then what is indecency? I mean, this is like barely legal status in porn or something. What is indecency?
You can think of it as obscenity light in a way, in that it is obscenity, as I mentioned earlier. It focused on hardcore depictions of sex that has no serious literary, scientific, or political merit. And you judge it by the work as a whole. Indecency was the FCC's effort in the 70s to come up with a standard that was like obscenity, where you could regulate for something less than obscenity, but under somewhat more broad standard. And so this is what it came up with. And oddly enough, the standard for indecency for FCC rules is very much like the legal standard that Comstock operated in the 19th century. And it basically says that while the First Amendment may protect indecent material, like Bono saying, this is fucking brilliant, that you don't have to look at the work as a whole. You don't have to look at whether or not it violates community standards for the average adult. You just look at whether a particular image or particular word might be bad for the children to see or hear. And so that's what it boils down to. And it can be a very broad net indeed. And depending on how much restraint the FCC uses when it's trying to enforce this standard. But to your specific question, what is indecency? Nobody knows.
Right. And the FCC, in both articulating this category and then failing to define it well, what were the legal and cultural repercussions of that abject failure?
Well, to begin with, the indecency standard is the only standard ever created by a stand-up comic, George Carlin, of course. Most people have heard of the seven dirty words. The actual monologue was called Filthy Words, but it became the seven dirty words because it was George Carlin riffing on what are the seven words you can't say on radio or TV. And he came up with shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cock, other motherfucker, and tits. And that became the defining case at the FCC for what indecency means. And the FCC was so amazed that they had won the case in the Supreme Court by a narrow margin. They decided that they would, for the first 10 or so years of its existence, would only enforce the indecency rules against those seven words. And so it became the George Carlin rule. It was, well, as I say, the only time a stand-up comic has created a legal standard. But over time, for political reasons and so on, the FCC would loosen what that means. It did it in the late 80s, did it again after the, quote, wardrobe malfunction and the Bono incident, to the extent that people were worried about anything. Live newscasts, for example, programs about veterans, programs that showed any kind of people in live or stressful situations. And so the repercussions of enforcement after this new wave of indecency enforcement censored a lot of programming on television.
And this is a chilling effect, right? Where you don't know what's wrong, you know, what's against the law, so you just kind of shut down.
Well, that's right. And the FCC did more than just raise its eyebrow as it had in earlier days. It imposed record-breaking fines. Congress multiplied the level of fines by 10 times. You know, even, and I give an example of this, and there's the image of this in the book, where local television stations in D.C. were covering an incident where a woman had attacked a Gauguin painting in the National Gallery. And it was two Tahitian women. And the painting itself, if you've ever seen it, shows two women side by side with their breasts exposed. And a woman had attacked it, saying it was an evil painting and very lesbian. And so the newscasts in the area, when they were showing this or illustrating this story, had a banner across the breasts because they didn't want to get in trouble with the FCC. That's how far things had gotten under this very lax standard.
And of course, this was also all happening against the backdrop of where broadcast radio and TV was losing market share both to internet and cable and satellite, you know, shows or offerings that were not restricted by the FCC in terms of content regulation. So do we emerge out of the indecency wars in a better place? Because the FCC kind of had to give up the ghost, right?
We do for a variety of reasons. One is because of the proliferation of other options, as you point out. I mean, people wouldn't think about any of this kind of censorship when it comes to streaming media or cable, and the law simply doesn't permit it. It's just that relic that applies to broadcast regulation. But even for that sector, we came out a little better because of the FCC's excesses, these issues didn't just get judged in the political arena, but in court. And so the courts reversed the FCC's fines on CBS for the Super Bowl incident. They reversed the fines of indecency for the live award shows and basically sent a message that the courts, including the lower courts, could evaluate FCC decisions for whether or not they went too far. And so it forced the FCC to be much more circumspect in what it does. And their efforts to enforce indecency ground to a halt. And those of the zealots, the activists like Brent Pizzell and Parents Television Council, essentially were ended. Because the FCC was constrained by the new law.
But now, of course, we have a different conversation about what is acceptable speech, and it's less even about violent TV shows, as if TV shows were ever that violent, or sexual TV shows, which were gigantic. You know, these were the conversations we had ad nauseum in the 80s and 90s, maybe in the early 2000s. But now we're talking about something that you call the anti-free speech movement. And this is not about the, you know, it's not about censorship of saying like, oh, there's, you know, dirty pictures and we got to shut that down. This is coming out of people like legal scholars, people like Richard Delgado, Catherine McKinnon, Mary Matsuda, literary critics who also taught in law schools like Stanley Fish, who talk about free speech and kind of First Amendment absolutism, First Amendment fundamentalism that somebody like you kind of, you know, represents, right? At least in their worldview, is problematic. What is their argument against kind of a marketplace of ideas where everything goes?
Well, you kind of have to pick your scholar because they kind of, you know,
there are focus differences
on their pet issues, whether it's, you know, hate speech or electoral speech in Citizens United, or you know, take your pick. There are a range of arguments that are made that free speech has gone too far. If you look at the early scholars talking about going after hate speech, you know, this scholarship began in the 1980s and into the 90s, and it continues now. Their argument is that these kinds of hateful terms and expressions do nothing to advance the marketplace of ideas, that they simply limit the ability of others and particularly marginalized people to participate in the marketplace of ideas. And they largely denigrate arguments for free expression by simply labeling the proponents of a more broad concept of free speech as being absolutists or fundamentalists. In that respect, and that the parallel that I draw in the book is that they use much the same tactics that Comstock did in going after his adversaries. And, you know, as far as First Amendment absolutists go, I don't think I've ever met one.
Right. So, well, you're not a First Amendment absolutist because you believe in certain types of speech should be prohibited, things like fraud or defamation, or if not prohibited, but it's actionable.
Well, no. What I believe is that the First Amendment has its limits.
Right.
Right. That it does protect expression, but that expression can exceed that boundary where it leads to a crime, for example. But for many of these theorists, the argument is that speech is hurtful in that it causes people pain, and that it's mental anguish and all of that.
Which is unquestionable, right?
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, I don't doubt that. And the Supreme Court has talked about how we protect speech because it's powerful, and that there are, as I say, there can be limits to that. But a lot of it is where you place the presumption. Do you put the presumption in favor of protecting speech, or do you put the presumption in favor of protecting, you know, whatever other sensibilities or values.
What do you say about the idea that certain types of speech keeps people from participating fully in the marketplace of ideas? And so, you know, a kind of paradigmatic example would be, is if college campuses allow everybody to speak, everybody to appear, you know, and you get people like Milo Yiannopoulos or the alt-right guy, Richard Spencer, are coming to campus. If you are the real or perceived target of some of their ideology, you know, that, you know, you feel uncomfortable at a university setting, you can't participate in classes or in campus life. And so, you know, in order for your participation, those people's speech rights should be curtailed. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, well, what's wrong with that is that there are no limiting principles to it, right? If you draw the line of protected speech at what makes someone uncomfortable, then you have basically censorship of everybody. And we saw this traced in First Amendment case law, most famously in the 70s with the attempt by members of the American Nazi Party to march in Skokie, Illinois, where you had many Holocaust survivors. What we found is the arguments in favor of censoring them were the same arguments that were used to keep people like Martin Luther King from demonstrating in neighboring communities. That the majesty of the First Amendment really is that it protects everyone, even if it makes you feel uncomfortable. Or take the example of the Westboro Baptist Church, which is this crazy cult from Kansas of people who believe that all of the nation's ills are because we have been too tolerant of homosexuals. And as a result, that's God's wrath. And so they have these really disgusting demonstrations, some of them at military funerals and so on, where they talk about how God hates fags in their the signs that they hold up. And what we find is that do people like that contribute to the marketplace of ideas? Well, in a sense, they do, in that the role of some people in the marketplace of ideas is simply to serve as a bad example. And what it does is it prompts people to respond with better arguments. And if you had ever seen any of these Westboro Baptist Church demonstrations, you find that most people really were engaged in counter demonstrations that were funnier and more persuasive. And the fact that we allow people like that to present hateful or virulent messages in society doesn't retard progress toward equality. It didn't retard the progress toward marriage equality. I can't imagine someone watching that kind of demonstration.
Oh, it's like, now I get it. Yeah. Now I know why I don't want gays to be married.
Yeah, exactly.
God hates them. But then right. People...
And even more recently, if you take the events of Charlottesville, for example, the counter demonstrations that happened in response to the hate speech, the hateful speech that we saw there, were much larger. And finally, when you had proper crowd control and proper police presence in demonstrations like Boston, the counter demonstrators outnumbered white supremacists or others who were with them by 800-1. And so that's the marketplace of ideas at work. Even when the speech is something that you would never defend or something that you find makes you extremely uncomfortable, that's how it works.
Young people, you talk towards the end of the book about, you know, developing, you know, not just a jurisprudence of free speech, which, you know, it has been, you know, growing. I guess let me ask you this one point. You know, you had said earlier that, you know, the First Amendment, you know, this, you know, the First Amendment's text has not changed, but our understanding of it has. And somebody like Stanley Fish, the, you know, legal scholar, you know, literary scholar and legal scholar, you know, very influential in a lot of rhetorical readings of law and power and things like that. He says, you know, that shows that the First Amendment is actually not something that exists independent from our ability to interpret it, but the First Amendment is a tool used by powerful interests to further their interests and to kind of maintain either a status quo or a system of oppression that somehow targets minorities, whether it's sexual minorities or racial minorities or ideological minorities. And, you know, it is true, like the same First Amendment now that guarantees so much speech had nothing, you know, offered no defense in 1800. Is Stanley Fish onto something? Or what is wrong with his kind of analysis there?
If you look at the history of this, you find that it is the protection of individuals that has made all of the mass movement by minorities, by previously marginalized people, possible throughout the 20th century. There wouldn't have been a gay rights movement or a women's movement. Certainly the civil rights movement was a defining time for protecting the speech of individuals. And what we see now is a continuation of that. And even through the more recent protests for Black Lives Matter and in the wake of the George Floyd killing, you know, it is the protections of the First Amendment that make those kinds of demonstrations possible.
So young people, towards the end of the book, you talk about how, you know, we need not just the jurisprudence of free speech, but a culture of free speech, because that's ultimately what determines what is able to be discussed, what is able to be expressed. And young people, you run through a lot of different polling data and survey data, and this is certainly something that anybody who follows kind of campus wars and a lot of other kind of related issues, finds people, younger millennials, Generation Z, do not have the same kind of reverence for, you know, I may hate your speech, but I'll defend it, you know, a kind of late 20th century kind of model of, you know, no, it's better to have more speech, you know, the way to combat bad speech is with more speech. Are you optimistic or are you pessimistic about the future of free speech? And, you know, how do you speak to a younger generation that is not coming from the same place that you might be?
Yeah, that is an excellent question and sort of a variation on the theme of children are our future.
Right.
Which
unfortunately, you know, it's also, I think the first Blood, Sweat, and Tears record or the second one is like, you know, child is the father to man. This is a big hippie boomer thing. So if we get screwed by our kids, Bob, we set ourselves up for that.
Yeah. Well, I think you put your finger on it earlier in our conversation when you said that the lived experience that we had is not what, people today are experiencing. And that is, you look at the current generation, they don't know what censorship of entertainment is. They've never experienced it. They have all kinds of information from all different sources. Whereas when we were kids, stand-up comics were being arrested, like Lenny Bruce. We have novels that were being prosecuted and censored. You had restrictions on movies that slowly were relaxed. You also had, as we discussed a minute ago, pervasive regulation of broadcasting, which has somehow eased or somewhat eased, but that's been accompanied by this proliferation of other sources, streaming media, cable, satellite communications, all of these different sources that are uncensored. So young people today don't have any concept of what it's like to have a censored media, and they haven't seen the kind of pushback that existed during the Vietnam War protests and the civil rights movement. And so it's understandable that there would not be the same sort of instinctive reaction to those kinds of things. We have different issues that we're facing today, but I think at the end I come out on an optimistic note simply because I think people are educable. And I think that those attitudes, when confronted with differing issues and circumstances, can be brought around. One of the points that I make in the book is that we learn more about the nature of free speech by looking at the mind of the censor, by looking at what the First Amendment was designed to prevent, rather than trying to speculate on what it might have been there to promote.
What, and just as a final note, because this kind of brings us to the very current moment, and it weaves together ideas of, you know, kind of disgust, science-based censorship, you know, what's good for you, and then this kind of new world where the public and private are not as clearly distinct as they might have been in the past. When you look at social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter, these are private platforms. The standard libertarian argument is these are private businesses that can dictate what gets said on their platforms or not. In the wake of 2016, in the wake of 2020 elections, people are, you know, in the, you know, coming out of an idea that, well, Facebook in particular knows so much about you, they can force you to buy certain things or see certain things or think certain ways. How do you feel, how do you deal with social media regulation and censorship? Obviously, people on the left and the right in the Senate and the House want to regulate this stuff. These platforms have said, we want to be regulated. But are you comfortable with actions such as Facebook and Twitter, you know, just weeks before the election, blocking a story that ran in the New York Post about a laptop purported to be Hunter Biden's? It turns out that it probably was, almost certainly. You know, how do you deal with this kind? Is this a continuation of censorship that you write about, or is this something different and needs a different lens of analysis?
I think it does need a different lens because we are talking about private platforms who have a First Amendment right of their own to determine what kind of community they want to foster, what their terms of use will be, and so on. I think the question, and this circles back to the point I made a minute ago, that we learn more about free expression by focusing on what censorship means. And that is, if you're worried about social media platforms and what they're doing, would you feel better if you put the government in charge of what they're doing? You're right that there are a number of proposals that are pending in Congress to regulate social media in various ways. They are as polarized as the society that they're trying to protect, in that you have progressives arguing that social media platforms should be either required or incentivized to police their platforms more rigorously so that false information doesn't get out there, or hateful information, or you pick your favorite subject, which ironically is the reverse position they took when you were talking about regulations like network neutrality. You have conservatives, on the other hand, saying that these platforms should be regulated as common carriers, or to have a new kind of fairness doctrine adopted, which again is the opposite of the position they normally take. So it really doesn't matter which side of that spectrum you gravitate toward. The answer is, this isn't a really good idea. And if you're worried about the power of these social media platforms, then you should worry more about consolidating that power in a single source, which will go one way or the other, depending on who happens to be in charge of the levers of power at any given time.
And that seems like it changes every 2, 4, or 6 years. So
exactly. Well, and just look at the fact that we go back and forth on whether or not we're going to advocate for network neutrality, depending on who happens to be the head of the FCC at a given time.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I've been talking with Robert Korn Revere, the great First Amendment lawyer and the author of The Mind of the Censor and the Eye of the Beholder. The subtitle is The First Amendment and the Censor's Dilemma. Bob, thanks so much for talking.
Thank you so much, Nick. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.